This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. Today it is the 29th of January 2011 here in Japan, and today I'm talking to Dr. Paul Conant of the Fluoride Action Network at fluoridealert.org, and listeners to episode 171 of the Corbett Report podcast, Professional Perspectives on Water Fluoridation, already know that the DVD of that documentary is available from the Fluoride Action Network. But I believe I erroneously indicated that that DVD was only available by donation. So first off, right off the bat, Dr. Conant, welcome to the program. And could you clarify how people can get a DVD copy of Professional Perspectives on Water Fluoridation?
Yeah, they can order it directly from our website. They can click on the icon there and order it. They can also order it from Amazon.com. And if they want multiple copies without the fancy packaging, we can give them a really decent rate. And that also is on the webpage, fluoridealert.org.
Excellent. Well, I would truly recommend that because I do think that this is an excellent, short, and very definitive way of showing that water fluoridation is not the medical wonder that it is sometimes portrayed to be by the CDC and other organizations that have a vested interest in promoting... Yeah, the industrial interests.
And also, James, if I could interrupt.
Please.
It also demonstrates the other incorrect impression that people have, and that is that the people opposed to fluoridation are a bunch of wackos. I mean, on that videotape, you see a mixture of doctors, dentists, scientists, a Nobel Prize winner, three members of the National Research Council panel that reviewed the toxicity of fluoride. So Ian Chalmers, who is one of the leading authorities on what constitutes good evidence in medicine. So there's a lot of heavy-hitting people there, and you just can't, the promoters simply can't keep trying to promote fluoridation on the basis of the opponents being rather nutty.
That's exactly right, and that's exactly the other point of the DVD that I wanted to stress, is that it does contain, obviously, professional perspectives, and there are dentists and doctors and scientists. So, again, it's incredible, not only for yourself, but for other people, and that's why I would recommend getting multiple copies of the DVD so that you can pass them out to other people, because I think it is a great tool for waking people up to what water fluoridation is really about. But I guess for this point, maybe we can take water fluoridation and its ills and dangers for granted, Ben, talk a little bit about some of the exciting news that's been coming out on this front. And I guess we have to start with the EPA's recent decision to reduce the maximum allowable levels of fluoride in water fluoridation.
Well, yes, that was the event of January the 7th, which was explosive. It wasn't just the EPA. It was also the Department of Health and Human Services, which is the parent body for the Center of Disease Control that's been promoting fluoridation so aggressively in the United States for many, many years. And they finally admitted that, rather about 50 years too late, that the levels that they're using are too high because of all the other sources of fluoride, resulting, incidentally, in 41% of children in the United States aged 12 to 15 having dental fluorosis, which is an indicator of overexposure to fluoride. So our kids in America are being overexposed to fluoride. They finally recognize that. What they should have done, of course, was to stop water fluoridation. What they have done is a rather weak compromise of lowering the so-called optimal mythical level, which is supposed to reduce tooth decay to 0.7 instead of the range of 0.7 and 1.2. Now, this was coupled with some very disturbing information. In fact, the EPA, the US EPA, or the Water Division, Office of Water, after nearly 5 years' delay, has finally responded to the National Research Council's recommendation that they lower the safe drinking water standard for fluoride. What was disturbing about the EPA's announcement is that they're working hand in glove with the Department of Health and Human Services, which amounts to reducing the safe drinking water standard without, notice this, without threatening the water fluoridation program, which in my view is absolutely illegitimate. Their task, the EPA's task, is not to be worried about benefits. The EPA's task is to actually come out and find what's the best scientific, the determined level which is protective of everyone as far as drinking water is concerned. And for them to allow the benefits to interfere with this is outrageous. And it's already produced some outrageous science. For example, they are saying that as far as producing severe dental fluorosis, which is now being considered a health effect as opposed to simply a cosmetic effect. So severe dental fluorosis is a cosmetic effect. And to protect that, they say they need a reference dose of point, well, forget the number. They got a reference dose. And this is derived with using, now get this, an uncertainty factor of 1. Now, what that means, when you say an uncertainty factor of 1, you're saying no margin of safety. No margin of safety from the level which has caused this harm. And in fact, they based this on a study done in 1942 of 5,000 children. And they are saying that if from that study, they've deduced that 1.97 parts per million was the cutoff point for causing dental fluorosis. And they are saying there's enough children in that study to be confident that you've taken into account the sensitivity of all the children in the America's population. Well, this is outrageous. I mean, normally we use the safety factor of 10. It's called intraspecies variation. Having established a level that causes harm, you then divide by 10 to make sure you've covered the whole range of sensitivity. And remember what you've got in a human population. You've got people that are sick. You've got people with poor nutrition. You've got people with genetic weaknesses. It's all kinds of people.
You have infants. You have elderly people.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, for dental fluorosis, though, it is children. So at least that part of it is fine. Now, what makes this doubly outrageous is that when you look at Dean's study, all the children were white. And so there is no extra factor to account for what might be more sensitivity amongst a different genetic strain like black people. And in fact, we do know from several studies, including the CDC's own study, that black children are more sensitive to getting dental fluorosis than white children. There's a higher prevalence amongst black children, possibly related to lactose intolerance, but maybe other factors as well. Obviously, that's completely gone by the board. So what we've got here, whether it was intended or not, is a clear case of environmental injustice. At the same time, the EPA is saying under Lisa Jackson that they want to fight regulations which perpetrate environmental injustice.
Well, it's absolutely incredible, but I think not very surprising for people who have been following this issue for decades and seen this kind of non-science used to prop up the other side. It's quite disgusting, really. And one of the first things that occurs to me with this is there a chance for legal recourse for people to do something to the agency that has put them under this for so long and is now admitting that it actually caused ill health effects?
Well, I don't know. It's not easy to sue the government. They got a really deep pocket. Obviously, this is a very entrenched policy from their perspective, and they're going to defend it like tigers as long as they possibly can. But let me go back to the roller coaster ride of the last few weeks, because that all happened on January the 7th. And it was rather schizophrenic. On the one hand, we got major coverage throughout the United States, top of the news items and on TV and front page articles and so on. All of a sudden, people are talking about fluoride. All of a sudden, they're recognizing it's not the bed of roses as being portrayed. And all that publicity was good from our point of view. On the other hand, it was clear that the EPA was going to sell us out and protect the fluoridation program, because if they actually derived an honest, scientifically defendable MCLG, it would be less than 1 part per million, less than 0.7 parts per million. Actually, it should be 0, which would eliminate fluoridation. So they have it within their grasp to eliminate water fluoridation. They decided not to do it. They have decided to protect this program rather than protect the people that they're supposed to be protecting. Okay, so it's a roller coaster ride. And I'm very angry. Other people are very excited. But then on Monday, we have another conference call organized with the EPA, this time with the pesticide division, where they're going to tell us what's happened to our 9-year effort to get them to stop permitting Dow AgriSciences using sulfuryl fluoride as a fumigant on food in warehouses, processing plants, and more recently, pre-fumigating food before plants are grown. This is to fight insects, etc. Now, our concern here is that when you use sulfuric fluoride for this purpose, you leave fluoride residues. It breaks down on the food, in the food, leaving free fluoride ion, and that actually dominated the health risk assessment that was done for the tolerances that they set for over 600 foodstuffs. And we've argued for 9 years that they can't possibly permit this because our kids are already being overexposed to fluoride. So if you add the existing exposure with the small increased exposure, possibly small increased exposure from sulfuric fluoride, it's unacceptable. It exceeds the reference dose as of that time. And, you know, that we've got the runaround for 9 years on this. We had to go through 3 different health risk assessments. We had to witness a massacre of science, let alone arithmetic, in the tortuous ways they tried to get around our objections. On Monday morning at 10 o'clock on January the 10th, they said, "We accept all your objections and we're going to phase out sulfuric fluoride."
Absolutely amazing.
It was staggering. I mean, we were dumbfounded. We just didn't expect to win like that. We were expecting to have to drag them into court and force them to reveal this awful dirty linen. I mean, I think people would be appalled if they saw what the pesticide division was doing with the numbers to try to justify the unjustifiable.
I can hardly believe that they've accepted all of the recommendations and are going to take it out. I mean, that's incredible. Do we have any quantified the amount of fluoride that was actually going to be left as a residue on food products after the fumigation process?
Yeah, we know at least the residues, which of course is not the whole story because you need to know how much of those residues are going to end up in the meals that people are going to eat. But we do know the levels that they were permitting, and some of them were outrageously high. For example, wheat flour, which goes into everything from pizzas to bread to cakes to cookies, 120 parts per million. Well, that's 120 milligrams per kilo. Well, I doubt if anybody eats an actual kilo of dough or bread a day, but some people are probably eating half a kilogram. And so if that dough or that bread is made up with the food which has been recently treated, they could be getting some very nasty doses. So, you know, a half a kilo, 500 grams, if it was treated stuff, you'd get 60 milligrams of fluoride, which is very nasty. That would make a kid sick. It's well over the safe levels. Anyway, and another one which was almost Monty Python. They actually, in the beginning, had accepted a tolerance for powdered eggs of 900 parts per million. Now, to put that into perspective, fluoridated toothpaste has about 1,000 parts per million. And if you look on the back of a tube of toothpaste, it says only use a pea-sized amount. And if you should swallow it, contact a poison control center immediately. Now, that's half a pea-sized amount. Now, how many pea-sized amounts do you have in one egg? How many pea-sized amounts do you have in an omelet or a cake baked with X number of eggs? It's staggering. It's stupid.
Yes,
I mean,
absolutely.
People would literally be vomiting if they were to, supposing they'd made up a batch which had just been treated and it was sent off to some kind of institute, hospital, school, college, army barracks. A lot of it goes to the military, powdered eggs. I mean, those people would be sick with the meals. They would just literally vomit that out.
So is there any indication of how they arrived at that number?
Yes, they work backwards, always work backwards. Dow goes and does its measurements, sees what levels are left in the food that it's treating, and then determines that that's the level that they want that should be accepted. And then the EPA comes in and says, okay, well, we'll accept those levels, and then do a health risk assessment to prove that even if you consume those levels, that you're okay.
Wow. Well, just again, another stunning thing. But it's so great that that has suddenly they've now taken it out. I mean, that's incredible. And to be clear, that is sulfural fluoride. Are there any other fluoride-based pesticides that are being used?
Yep, cryolite. Cryolite has been used for a very long time on foodstuffs, grapes and things, so that's another area of concern. But the residue levels for cryolite have never reached the astronomical levels of sulfural fluoride. And to a certain extent, cryolite is insoluble, so it doesn't quite have the same impacts as, or certainly sulfural fluoride. Hats off. We were very, very lucky, the Fluoride Action Network, because we got support in our efforts from several sources. One was the Beyond Pesticides, a Washington-based group fighting all kinds of pesticides. So that was great. And we had the Environmental Working Group, which has a huge amount of clout in Washington, D.C. And it was through their help that we got a pro bono law firm to help us, a really big law firm, and a wonderful lawyer, Perry Wallace. And if this guy had ever got them to court, they would have just run away, because he was so good. And you know, you get breaks every so often. To have someone of this guy's stature and this company's clout working for free in the public interest was so exciting. And a lovely fellow too. Wonderful to work with. A wonderful, calm manner who just steered us through 9 years. And also hats off to my wife. It's my wife who's been the head person pushing on the sulfural fluoride issue. She has maintained on our webpage, fluoridealert.org, a huge database of fluorinated compounds, because she became increasingly concerned of how many fluorinated compounds were going onto the marketplace, fluorinated pesticides, fluorinated plastics, fluorinated solvents, all kinds of fluorinated compounds. And by and large, the environmental community has been so focused on chlorinated products like DDT, dioxins, furans, PCBs, and so on. They haven't quite noticed this insidious growth in the number of fluorinated products out there on the market. The one that's really hit home is PFOs, used in Scotchgard and things like that, used in fabrics, treating fabrics and so on, and they're finding these everywhere, just as they found PCBs in the fat of every mammal, including human beings throughout the world. They're finding the same thing with these PFOAs and stuff. Perfluorinated octanol acids, I think the full name is. Anyway, she's been a real hawkeye, documenting the toxicity of all these substances. And one of the things that she noticed is one of two of them in animal studies left holes in the brain, and not many. And that always caught her attention. And one of the ones that came through was sulfural fluoride. That causes holes in the brain of animals. You know, it's similar to mad cow's disease is what you're getting here. So even though the amount of sulfural fluoride that was going to be left of these foodstuffs was small, it was a worryingly toxic substance in its own right, even though fluoride dominated the health risk assessment.
Worrying indeed, yes. Well, yeah. Certainly is. And luckily, the EPA has made their recent announcement. But how about on the international scene? We have lots of international listeners to this program.
Yes. Well, that was good. I'm glad you've raised that. In Canada, they've only used sulfural fluoride to fumigate empty warehouses, empty containers. And I guess they wait until the nasty stuff is dissipated and they've killed all the insects, before the boll weevils and so on, before they put the foodstuffs in. So Canada had already had taken sensible steps. Other countries have avoided the use of this substance, as far as I know, because they have other methods, carbon dioxide, refrigeration, etc., to beat these pest problems. And Australia, I believe, had introduced sulfural fluoride, and I'm not quite sure what their response has been to this announcement by the EPA.
Interesting. Well, hopefully we can ascertain that, and hopefully they will be thinking of phasing it out themselves as well. That seems like such an important front, because a lot of people don't understand that fluoride is more than just water fluoridation, and as you just indicated, there are numerous sources for fluoride in our daily lives.
I wouldn't hold out any hope for Australia. I think they are the most arrogant country as far as the whole issue of regulating the environment and water fluoridation in particular. I mean, several states now have mandatory fluoridation in Australia. Queensland introduced just a couple of years ago mandatory fluoridation, so that towns in Queensland, which had resisted fluoridation for 50 years, including Brisbane, suddenly found themselves forced to have it, whether they wanted it or not. No vote. Victoria has mandatory fluoridation, and they've been mopping up every last conceivable town, and they can't get the government to allow them to vote on it. They won't debate the issue. They won't answer citizens' questions. They say, you're going to have it whether you want it or not. And their pathetic MPs, by and large, are letting this happen. It is the most depressing thing for me as an English born in England, having visited Australia several times, having admired their sports persons, players for many years, particularly the cricket players, to see what a bunch of wimps they are when it comes to fighting this arrogance from their governments. And I'll give you an example of the arrogance. Unfortunately, the press wasn't there. I wish you'd been there, James, with a tape recorder to witness this. I had challenged the chief health officer of Victoria, Australia, to debate me on fluoridation because they were promoting it like crazy. He said, no, I won't debate you. But he says, you can come to my office and we can talk about it. So I trundled along to his office. But before I went, this was a few years back, I sent him a copy of a statement that I'd made, 50 reasons to oppose water fluoridation. So I sent that ahead of time. And then we went to the meeting, there were about four or five of them, his advisors, etc., there were about four or five of us. And the first question I asked this health officer was, have you read the 50 reasons to oppose fluoridation? He says, yes, but it hasn't changed my opinion, our position on fluoridation. I said, well, would you provide a written response to these 50 reasons? And he looked me straight in the face and says, neither I nor my staff have any intention of doing that.
Hmm.
Just like that. And this is at the same time that they're paying a fortune to a public relations outfit to prepare a document, answers to frequently asked questions on fluoridation. Hmm. So clearly they could contrive answers to their own questions, but they weren't so good at providing answers to the tough questions from people who knew something about the issue. The second question I asked him with James was, if fluoride is good for children's teeth or good for babies, why is it that the level in mother's milk is so incredibly low? It's about 200, 250 times lower than the level we add to the water. And he looked at me again. He says, well, he says, Mother Nature has dealt some children a raw deal. Now, I can only assume that the children that were dealt the raw deal were the ones that were born in communities that weren't fluoridated in his mind.
Hmm.
That the state
Ridiculous.
Of Victoria has to correct nature's mistakes.
Absolutely ridiculous. And I think that clearly demonstrates that the people on the other side of the argument have to rely on these sorts of ridiculous statements to back up what they're doing. And it's just unfortunate, I guess, for the people of Australia. But at the same time that that unfortunately fluoridation is taking over and completely taking over in Australia, the tide is beginning to turn in North America. And I understand some big cities are, excuse me, in the process of removing the fluoride.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, we've had some amazing developments. We had a big referendum in Waterloo. We say fluoridation met its Waterloo in Ontario. In Waterloo, they voted out fluoridation after about 40 years. It was a very close referendum. That was October the 25th. A few days ago, a committee of the City of Calgary voted 5-1 to remove fluoride from the city of Calgary. That would be huge, a huge victory. It's not complete because the full council has to vote on it. But as far as we can see, the majority of the councillors want fluoridation stopped in Calgary, which on top of this Waterloo decision and on top of several other communities in Ontario that have stopped, and of course Quebec City stopped a few years ago, a lot is happening in Canada. And I was in Ottawa yesterday, funnily enough, giving a talk to citizens there. There's a growing group in Ottawa that wants to get it out of that city. And Canada is just a little less doctrinaire on this issue, both officials and dentists and so on. They seem to be more reasonable than the American counterparts. Maybe that's my prejudice showing, but I live just across the border from Canada, so I'm always, my wife and I are always going across the border to go to Ottawa and other places. Anyway, and the other, there's a very exciting movement in Austin, Texas, trying to get it out there. And the latest, the very latest, is that Peter Vallone Jr., a councillor in New York City, has introduced a bill to get it out of New York City. And if New York City fell, the United States' largest city, if that was to fall, if that was to end fluoridation, then I think it's the beginning of the end of fluoridation in North America, and I suspect throughout the world. So we are so close, tantalizing close, to seeing this 60-year nonsense finally coming to an end, although I suspect other people have said that and then been very, very disappointed. We're still up against a huge lobby for this practice. The American Dental Association raises $100 million a year. They have 20 full-time lobbyists in Washington. You've got the support, the massive support of the Department of Health and Human Services with this massive budget and clout and influence and so on. This is not going to be easy by any means, but yeah, certainly things have been happening in the last few months which we didn't even dare dream of just even a few months ago.
Absolutely.
And on top of all this, we've got the book out. So we've got a lot of substance. For those people now who suddenly are opening up to this issue, they find we've got a great web page with all the information you could possibly want, the fluoridealert.org. You've got this great videotape that you kindly circulated the soundtrack of. Thank you for doing that. We've got now over 3,500 professionals calling for an end to fluoridation and growing every day. And we've got this book, The Case Against Fluoride, which is authored by myself, a chemist, environmental chemist, James Beck, who's from Calgary, who's leading the battle there. He's an MD, PhD, biophysicist. Medical physics, get it right at the moment. And finally, Spedding Micklem from Scotland, who's a PhD from Oxford, biologist. We're a biologist, chemist, and a physicist who've written this book, and we've done it with a minimum of exaggeration and emotion. We've tried to keep to the straight and narrow, look at things as objectively as we can. We don't hide the fact that we've looked at this practice, we are opposed to it, but we still try to recognize the other side's arguments. But every single fact in that book is documented, and hopefully it's readable. So we've written a book that we hope that the average person will be able to read, intelligent person will be able to read, but also be aware that if they need it, all the documentation is there. And by the same token, it's a book that any doctor or scientist or academic could read, and I think would be fully satisfied that we're backing up what we say. And if this was a rational world, of course it isn't, but if it was, a year from now, I would hope that there would be a book on the market which would be The Case for Fluoride, where all those proponents of fluoridation out there, from government officials to dentists to dental societies, would pool their efforts and resources and come back with a book giving the opposite case and refuting all the arguments that we're making. And if that were to happen, I think then the citizen and the professors and students at our universities and med schools and so on would be in a luxurious position of having two books, read both of them, and be able to compare the documentation and the science behind the two sides of this debate. But I doubt very much that they will happen. I think they'll play true to form and completely ignore the existence of this book and continue undaunted.
Unfortunately, that's probably the case, and I agree. It's often tempting to just make fun of the other side and belittle their claims, but it's important to have a full presenting of the facts of both sides and let people decide for themselves. So that's why it's important to have things like the Fluoride Action Network and your new book. Tell people how they can get more information about that book.
Well, the book is published by a small publisher in Vermont called Chelsea Green. They have a very good reputation. It's available on Amazon.com, and I think that's probably the easiest. I'm not saying it's the cheapest way of getting the book, but I would say it's the easiest thing to remember. You can read more about the book. There's umpteen interviews and videotapes and reviews of the book on the Chelsea Green website. So that's ChelseaGreen.com. And put in fluoride, you'll immediately get our book, a description of the book, description of the authors. As I said, lots of interviews, reviews, and a lot of good stuff there.
Excellent. And just before we go, I think before we leave the topic of the exciting news from New York City, perhaps you can mention how people can support that campaign if they're in or New York or know people who are.
Oh, yes. Oh, very good. We have a wonderful person who's been working so hard on this for many years, who's actually largely instrumental in getting fluoridation out of Long Island, which is interesting. So cheek to jowl to New York City, we have Long Island with 3 million people who are not drinking fluoridated water. And guess what? Their teeth are above average in New York State. They're certainly not below average. I think they're better than the teeth in New York City. But be that as may, that the woman's name is Carol Kopf, K-O-P-F, and she's our media officer, and she's also the media officer of the New York State Coalition Opposed to Fluoridation, and she's the point person to generate support for this counselor, Peter Vallone, in this effort. And her email address is NYSKOF, which stands for New York State, N-Y-S, Kopf, Coalition Opposed to Fluoridation, COF, NYSCOF, at AOL.com. So please, anyone, contact her, certainly if you live in New York City. Secondly, if you have friends and relatives who live in New York City, get them to contact her. If you have people that live in New York State and visit New York City frequently, or anybody that visits New York City, we have an online messaging system which people can tailor-make to their own relationship to this city and urge these councillors to vote it out.
Well, some very exciting things happening on a number of fronts, and that's why I think we can agree that this is the time to increase our efforts rather than to lay down. So I'm very glad
Absolutely.
That Fluoride Action Network is there doing that. So any final thoughts before we leave the listeners today?
Well, I just want to thank you, James, because, you know, unless we have people like yourself taking the time and interest and researching these things for yourself and then giving voice to them and getting it out into cyberspace, all our efforts would not go very far. And thank God that we have people like yourself and people like Dr. Joe McCullough who have access to lots and lots of people in cyberspace, on internet. And really, that's kept this issue alive for so long because the major media was not doing justice to this issue. Investigative journalism seems to have died in the United States. So if it hadn't been for the websites and for these new services from the internet, things like yourself, we wouldn't have kept this issue alive, and we wouldn't have the base that we now have, this base which is growing every day. And don't forget that those professionals, if there's any professionals listening to this, any MDs, any PhDs, any nurses, any dental hygienists, any pharmacists, anybody with a health, medical, environmental professional, go to our webpage and add your name to the professional signing that statement to calling for an end to fluoridation worldwide. Every name is worth its weight in gold right now.
Indeed. Well, I wholeheartedly second that recommendation, and I agree that that we are starting to win the PR battle because we actually have access to so many people through cyberspace. So we have to continue doing what we're doing. And on that note, I certainly hope we can have you again on the program again to update us about some of these ongoing issues.
Anytime, James. I'm going to be pretty busy over the next few months. I'm going to Australia 3 times, if they let me in after all the nasty things I've just said, to New Zealand on one of those trips that combined with New Zealand, the Virgin Islands, Europe again, England and Italy. So I'm going to be very, very busy traveling, which is unfortunate as it happens, because I really need to be at home at this point to capitalize on all the interviews, etc., which people are seeking. Hopefully we can do it over emails and over Skype and stuff. But
all right. Well, I will keep in touch. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you very much, James. Bye for now.